We're learning Baba Kama. We're beginning now the 8th chapter, the first Mishnah. This is a completely different subject, one we have not really had that much contact with yet. So as usual, we'll first begin with the Mishnah. So let's see. I guess this Mishnah is for you, Baba. Oh, you have that?
Oh, this is for anybody who needs it.
Thank you very much.
Took our whole.
So the Mishnah, we'll read through the Mishnah slowly and translate it. So let me ask, you have an edition of the Mishnah line I've never seen before, I think.
Oh, you mean Alma Sefer?
Shisha Sitoi Mishnah.
Oh, I don't think in one book?
Yeah.
I've never seen that before, I think.
Oh, it's a new series. It was published by the Idiot
Note. Very nice. Is there a little commentary there?
No.
Just straight the Mishnah.
Straight.
Vocalized?
Straight text.
Vocalized?
With
Minukad. Okay. So the Mishnah says, the beginning of Perek Shmita, the 8th chapter, HaChovel B'Chaviro, which means someone who injures his fellow. And notice the preposition bi, hachovel bi, does damage in or to chaviro, his fellow. Chayav alav mishum chamisha dvarim. He is culpable alav, in this case, because of him, concerning him, him meaning the person who has been injured, mishum chamisha dvarim. I don't know how we would translate mishum. In the category of five things, or because of five things, something like that.
In regarding
to five things. What are those five things? Benezik. The word is nezik, damage. Bitsar. Tsar is pain. Biripui. Ripui is doctor bills. Language of rifuah means healing. Bishevet. Shevet from language of Shabbat. Or shvita, which means a strike, or sitting down, shevet. In other words, for unemployment. Shevet is unemployment, having to sit and not go to work. Uva boshet, and for humiliation. So even before we go on with the Mishnah, we can just make a few comments concerning what we just read. So we just read that if you do damage to your fellow, you injure your fellow, you have to pay five different types of payments. Now, immediately, we said, wait a second, does it really mean that you have to pay, in all cases, five different payments? That can't be. Why can't it be?
Because then it would be one payment.
No, five separate payments.
Yeah, why not?
But I'm saying, for certain, that in many cases, it's not five payments, it's only four. Sometimes it's only three, sometimes it's only two.
Right. If he died, you don't need to pay the doctor.
Okay.
Well, then you don't always insult somebody.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Right.
And then sometimes you only insult somebody.
Right.
You know, slap them or spit
well,
on them.
Yeah. Okay. So what that means is that when it said, Chayav alav mishum chamisha dvarim, he's culpable concerning him for five things, if we really want to be exact, we have to add another word in there. In English or in Hebrew, what word do we have to add in?
Ad.
Okay, very good. You know, up to five things, or at the maximum five things, right? Mm-hmm. That's what it means. Because sometimes there's no doctor bills, sometimes there's no unemployment, sometimes there's no humiliation. But in the worst case scenario, it could be that five different types of damages were done, and we have to pay these five categories. Okay, that's one point I wanted to make. Another point I wanted to make is, notice the I'm going to create a phrase. The prepositional inconsistency. So I use that phrase, I think, on the sheet, right? Prepositional inconsistency in the sentence we just read. Tell me what I mean. Prepositional inconsistency.
Well,
you said you made a big point about the ba.
Yes, I did.
But why? I don't understand.
Why isn't it et? Is that just the Mishnah Hebrew verses?
Where would you want the et?
Chovel et.
Ah. So all I can say is that chovel is always followed by be.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Chovel b'chaviro.
Yeah.
That's the phrase. Yeah.
So is that inconsistent?
No.
So what is the inconsistency?
I asked you that question.
Well, I'm asking you back, and you just tell us.
No.
No,
because
it's not the class.
You actually don't have to know anything to notice the inconsistency, because it's here within the sentence. There's an inconsistency. I don't mean inconsistent with something else. I mean right within this one statement, there's inconsistency.
In this clause here, or are you?
Yeah, this clause within the clause itself, this inconsistency.
It doesn't say ooh, bub.
No, that's
bullshit. But that's
no, that's correct.
That's just pronunciation.
No, that's how it should be.
Yeah, after.
I'll give you a hint.
Okay.
When it says hachovel b'chaviro. And then it gives you the five things, right? The
yeah.
five categories.
Yes.
Which means that the phrase Chamisha Dvarim.
Oh, why does it include that at all? It's redundant? Well, that's not inconsistent.
That's not inconsistency, but we're getting close. So now that you know.
You're saying it should have said Nezik Tsar Rikui Shavit Boshit. Without the bets.
Very good, you're getting close. That's. So now what is the inconsistency? You tried to answer it, but what is the... You gave the answer, but what's the question? What is the inconsistency?
What was the answer?
That I said that there shouldn't be bets at all in those five lessons.
There should just be one?
Nezik Tsar.
Ah, yeah, uh-huh.
Okay, so now what's the inconsistency?
A man who damages, a pain. It'd be like connected to the word chovel. I don't know,
Bill. You know, I'm sure you know. You're going to knock yourself on the head when you realize.
But that wouldn't be clear.
And what should have been?
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been Ben, but then it would not be.
Where could have been Ben? Where? Okay! Okay! So now, what's the inconsistency?
Now,
say it. You didn't have to say it now. Say it.
But you said it's up.
Why?
To
the other way around. Mishum nezik, mishum tsar.
Very good. Now state the inconsistency.
Why?
Now state the inconsistency.
It says mishum here and it says b here.
Very good. Okay. Right?
What?
Achovel b'chaviro chayav alav mishum hamisha dvarim. So this is telling us that the preposition that precedes hamisha dvarim is mishum. I don't know why that's the preposition, but it is. And if that's the preposition that precedes Hamisha Dvarim, then it should have said Mishum Nezik, Mishum Tsar, Mishum Ripui, Mishum Shevet, Mishum Boshet. Or it could have left out the preposition like Lan suggested. It could have said Hachovel B'chaviro Chayal Avav Mishum Hamisha Dvarim Nezik, Tsar, Ripui, Shevet, and bullshit. But what it did is it switched prepositions in the middle of the sentence. If you tell me that Hamisha Dvarim is preceded by Mishum, then you can't, in the same sentence, tell me that the preposition is going to be Bih. It's Shum. It's Mishum. It's like saying the following.
But it sounds so terribly beautiful.
But just to think about it, let's bring an example in English. I walked to five places.
Yeah.
Okay? I walked to five places. I walked in the store, in Ilana's house, and in the synagogue. You can't say that. I walked to five places. It should be to the store, to Ilana's house, to the synagogue. But you can't say, I walked to five places, and the five places I walked to are, I walked in the store, I walked in the synagogue, I walked in... If you use the preposition to, and you say that that's the preposition that follows the verb and precedes the object, then you have to be consistent.
So do you think that it's a conglomeration of two sources?
Thank you very much. It's clearly a source here that's composed of two earlier sources that use different preprations.
Is it possible?
Preposition, sorry.
Well, how about if it's trying to indicate that you could be liable for one or more? Does it help make that distinction?
No. Not at all.
Is it at all possible that the person that wrote this was just a little ignorant in grammar, and that was the way they would have said it?
Actually, no, because it's the most beautiful.
This
isn't a matter of grammar, in the sense of knowing the right preposition. I know what the right preposition is, but whatever it is, there's a right preposition, and any other prepositions.
So it really sounds odd to you to say it this way.
Well, the truth is, it took me an hour of learning this Mishnah until I realized, wait a second. I mean, I've heard this Mishnah hundreds of times in my life, and I'm used to it.
Yeah, I'm used to it too. Yeah. It sounds to be so musical and beautiful.
But it's completely inconsistent. So what would the solution be? There are three possible solutions. We already said two of them. Mm-hmm. It could have said, HaChovel v'chaviro, Hayav alav mishum hamishrat dvarim, and then said mishum nezik, mishum tsar, mishum ripui, mishum shevet, mishum boshet. Or it could have left out the preposition this second time and just sort of said Hayav alav mishum hamishrat dvarim, nezik, tsar, ripui, shevet, boshet. But what's the third possibility? If we want to be consistent, what's the third possibility we could have done? Right, I just said two possibilities. And the third possibility is simply a matter of the laws of logic. Oh, come on.
Yeah, I'm losing that.
Say the second possibility again. What was the second?
The first possibility is
was putting
retain
in front
the
of
first preposition. Uh-huh. And change the second ones to what the first is.
Right.
That's the first possibility. Mishum, 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 mishum. Right. The second possibility is retain the first preposition and remove the second. Just make it nezek, tsar, ripui, shevet, boshet. Logically speaking, what's the third possibility?
Take the last preposition, put it in.
Of course.
Yeah, of course.
Right?
Yeah.
Take the last preposition and put it in place of the first preposition, which would be. But it's logic. HaChovel b'chaviro hayav alav b'chamishad varim b'nezik b'tzar b'ripui b'shev. But that also would have been good.
Well, no, because if the point is to say that it's not necessarily all five, then you need to indicate that somehow.
No, but it's not. That has nothing to do with it. However you use the prepositions, there's no indication in this direction or that direction.
Well, if mishum is supposed to mean until.
No, it doesn't mean that.
It doesn't. So what is
It's just because of. Just like bi means because of. It's the same thing. It's the same thing.
Okay.
Right. Remember that this is one of the first things they said to me when I was learning Hebrew 30 years ago. That prepositions are the hardest part of learning a new language.
Any language.
Because
they don't make sense.
They don't make. You can't give me a logical reason why in Hebrew it should. You go in English. You say I'm going to the store, and in what's a good example?
I'm at the store and I'm in the store.
Yeah.
Spanish would say I'm in the store.
Right.
I had a friend that knew 27 languages, and he said the worst part for him is always the preposition.
Yeah. So in this case, there's no logical reason why the preposition should be mishum or should be bi. Whatever it is, it is. But it can't be both. And even if it could be both, theoretically, it can't be both in the same sentence.
Right.
Okay, so there's nothing deep to learn in that, just to pay attention to the structure of language.
Sensitivity to text.
Indeed.
Well.
So... And like Ilana said, what we probably learned from that is that there's a history to this text. There probably was a text that said a chovel b'chaviro chayav alav mishum chamishad v'rim, period. And it didn't say what they are. And there's another text that said something like a chovel b'chaviro chayav alav b'nezik, b'tsar, b'ripui, b'shevet, b'boshet. And then these two texts were combined. And what you got is this conglomeration of inconsistent prepositions.
But why combine them if there's, it's redundant?
Good for you, Amira.
Right. The way I presented the two texts, it didn't make any sense.
Right.
Any
there
sense
was nothing.
It's probably more complicated than that. I again don't know what these texts were.
Sure.
You know, it could be that if I did a lot of research, we looked in the Tosefta, for example.
That's what I was thinking.
We could have probably found the original text that this is made from. I didn't do that. I didn't make that effort. Perhaps I should have, but I didn't.
I thought you unearthed for us this deception.
And by the way, I'll just say that that type of investigation of the history of a text, I was not trained in. In yeshiva, you don't learn that type of thing. That's the type of thing you learn in academic settings of textual
studies. So in the yeshiva, they don't analyze the text as a textual.
We don't analyze the history of the text.
Yeah.
Right. In general, in traditional religious frameworks, the text is taken as a given.
Yes.
And you begin from there. Right. Whereas what I just started to do is to take the text only as a beginning and then search for its prehistory. Mm-hmm. So that's something I wasn't trained in, but I assume the proper thing to do would be go to the Tosefta and see if we could find the building blocks from which this Mishnah was created.
The Talmud doesn't unearth that one.
Not that I know of. Okay. The Talmud sometimes will bring brightot,
right.
But it won't specifically say, it won't specifically point out the history of a text.
I guess unless there's something not clear.
Unless it has some practical significance. Right. Okay, so now let's talk about something else now, which is the fact that this Mishnah is utterly unique in relationship to everything we've learned in Baba Kama for the past year and a half.
Because before we had Nezakim, but not personal, not with people.
What does with people mean?
Or I guess by...
By
prepositions again.
Which? By people?
Oh, by, right. You know, it's
by people, for people, and
people damaging people.
Right. Yeah, we had bulls damaging people.
Right. But we haven't had people hurting people, or people hurting.
That's in honor of Bob, so we start something fresh.
Right. People hurting people in honor of me, okay.
So we've dealt until now with Shin Regel Karen and Bor.
Now we have Adama Mazik.
And even a little bit of Aish.
Yeah.
But we haven't dealt with Adam HaMazik. Right, to explain to Bob, who wasn't here, we've dealt with Shein, which is teeth, that when the animal gets pleasure, gets hana'a from doing damage to objects or to persons. And we've had Regel, when it tramples, in the course of its normal activity, it causes damage to people or to property. And we've had Karen, which is when an animal
aggressively
causes damage to people or to objects. We've had Boar. What is Boar?
Pit.
What's the definition of a Boar, basically?
It's a damaging object. Damaging public nuisance.
Okay, the word is a obstacle in Rishut Rabim.
Right.
Usually an obstacle. And that again is not you directly that's causing damage, it's something you created, the boar you created or the boar you owned, that's causing damage to property or to people. And we've also talked a little bit, although not a lot, about Ish, right? About fire.
So
which again is something not
stuff,
you.
The previous stuff was called tort in English, right?
I'm not good at that. Here's our lawyer.
How about humans damaging humans?
Still a tort.
Also torts?
Okay, so that's worth it.
It's all these cakes all over the place.
Anything between two people is called a tort, basically, within reason. And then when you do some sort of something that the community, the state, the federal government, your local government feels is so bad that they want you to stop it, then it's a crime.
But so you can do the same to damage. Separate that from crime.
You can do the same damage between two people for a tort or a crime. Just depends who wants to argue about it.
I can't see her. Is that peanut butter?
It's peanut butter, yes.
Just wanted to make sure I knew what I was saying. Okay. So, all the previous seven chapters have talked about, like we said, your possessions or your animals doing damage to people or to possessions, the property. This is the first time we're talking about Hachovel B'Chaviro, which is Adam HaMazik, man directly causing damage. But I did want to point out that in each of the three first chapters, there was a slight mention of Adam HaMazik. It wasn't dealt with directly as the major subject of any chapter, but let's just notice that. So we go to chapter one. I guess Bob doesn't have what you have over there. So in chapter 1, as far as I remember, was the end of the chapter, was a slight mention of Adam HaMazik, and that was on the last Mishnah, which is Mishnah Dalit, of the first chapter, right up at the middle of the Mishnah. It had, let's just read the whole Mishnah, Mishnah Dalit of the first chapter, it's the last Mishnah. Hamisha Tamin v'Hamisha Muadin, right? There are five cases of damage that is done by Tam, a damager that's not expected to damage, and Hamisha Muadim, and those who are forewarned to damage. Of course, the difference is, in the case of Tam, you only pay how much?
Half.
Half, and in Muad, you pay full. Habema ina muedit ela ligach. I'm sorry. Lo ligach, velo ligo, velo lishoch, velo lirbots, velo livot. Those are five types of damaging that animals do that they're not forewarned, and therefore, if they do them, it only has the owner only has to pay half damage. Hashen muedit lechol derurila. Teeth. An animal with teeth is considered to be forewarned to eat those things it usually eats. So if the animal eats something it usually eats, then it's considered to be full damage.
Right.
Feet trample on those things that are in its path. So if it tramples something in its path, it's full damage. It's expected to do that. Vashur muad. And shur that did damage four times, or ox that did damage four times, three times, is muad. Vashur mazik birshut anizak. And an ox that damages, if it went into someone else's property, it has to pay full damage. V'ha'adam. So there, it said Adam is also mu'ad. When Adam does damage, he never has to pay half, only always has to pay full. So in this list of mu'adim, those that have to pay fully, is Adam. So you see there, we have a slight mention of Adam HaMazik in chapter Aleph. But the rest of the chapter is not talking about Adam HaMazik. The same thing in chapter Bet. The chapter is talking not about Adam HaMazik, but about property. But there was one little mention of Adam HaMazik.
In Mishnah Vav.
Very good. Okay, 2 points for Ilana. Mishnah Vav. The last Mishnah of the second chapter. Adam Muad Leolam.
Six.
Yeah, right? Man is always considered to be forewarned. Any damage you do, you're responsible, and you have to pay full damage. You can never say, I didn't intend it, I didn't mean it, I didn't notice. You should have noticed. You should have. And we even said that a man is forewarned even if he damages when he's sleeping.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If you fall off a bed, we learned, and you fall on someone and break their leg, you have to pay full damage because Adam Muad Leolam. Now, of course, we learned the condition. Anyone remember?
If that person crept while you slept.
Right. If the person crept under your bed while you were sleeping, then you don't have to pay if you fell on him and broke his leg. But as long as he was there when you went to sleep, you should have noticed. And that's what the Mishnah says, Bein Shogeg, Bein Mezid, whether you intended or didn't intend it, whether you were sleeping, whether you were awake, you have to pay full damage. And then in chapter 3 there was also a little mention of Adam, even though basically the chapter is not about Adam but about your possessions causing damage. And if I remember what it is, right, it's in Mishnah Vav also. Mishnah Vav of chapter 3, the 6th Mishnah.
Oh, this is the guy running home on Shabbat?
Yeah. Well, not just on Shabbat.
Right.
But we talked about Shabbat.
Yeah.
Erev Shabbat.
Erev Shabbat.
Shnaim shayu mahalchin birshut harabim. Two that were walking in Rishut harabim. Echad ratz v'chad mahalech. One is running, one is walking. O shayu shneihem ratzim. Or both were running. V'iziku ze'etzeh. And they caused damage this to that. Shneihem peturim. They're both exempt. Now that came in just because we were talking about people walking Shtabim with
Stress.
Burdens
uh-huh.
and their
yes.
objects cause damage. But since we're already talking about people walking, it also talks about people walking even without carrying burdens and hurting the other directly with their body. So the matter of Adam HaMazik Adam, causing damage, got him here, but it's not the main subject, not of chapter 1, not of chapter 2, not of chapter 3, neither 4, 5, 6, or 7, but finally in chapter 8, the whole subject is Adam HaMazik, man himself doing damage directly. And I have one more question, it's a trick question, before we move on to the rest of today's Mishnah. A trick question means it's so easy that you probably won't realize the answer. And the question is, if our Mishnah today said that Adam HaMazik has to pay up to 5 types of payments, Nezik, Tsari, Pui, Shevet, Boshet, which one of them has been discussed for the past 7 chapters?
Nezik.
It's a person's a trick question.
Because if he's carrying Korah, a piece of wood, or if he's living, he's indirectly already creating Nezik.
Say it again?
Adam HaMazik, and now it's and that is unclear to me. Is it the issue that he is, the difference that we have now is that he is Chovel B'Chaverot without an object, like punching him?
Yes.
So if he takes a gun?
Very good question. Now, the question asked in the Gemara is an arrow. They didn't have guns. Like when I shoot an arrow at you, excuse me, and I injure you, is that considered to be that I didn't do it, my arrow did it? And therefore, it's not a Adam HaMazik, it's simply like walking the street with your Korah, with your beam, and you knock into someone. So now my arrow knocked into you. Or is it considered to be an extension of my hand, the arrow? So it's really, is it a Adam HaMazik, or is it a possession of mine? It's a good question. The Gemara talks about that. I don't remember the answer.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, in all the previous chapters, when we talk about the axes damaging, or a boar causing damage, or H causing damage, you only have to pay Nezik. You don't have to pay Shevet for the unemployment. You don't have to pay Ripui, doctor bills, etc. When it's your possessions causing damage, all you have to pay for is the damage you cause. But when you do it directly, then we have up to Hamishad Varim.
And there's really a question as to whether when you own an animal and it's trained and you cause the animal to go as an extension of yourself to cause the damage, there's really a question as to whether you have those 5 categories or only...
You mean if you sent your ox to
is
hurt
that
somebody?
You mean if you sent your ox?
If you sent the arrow, or if you sent your dog, or if you sent... If you caused it to happen, there's really a question whether that's not the 5 categories?
So in the case of the arrow, yes, it's a question.
Really?
But let's talk about the animal.
Yes.
So
people train attack dogs, for example.
Have we had anything about?
We haven't talked about somebody sending their dog on somebody.
But Shomu Ad, he didn't set the show on another person.
So all I know, Bob, is that if your animal causes damage to someone else, all you have to pay for is the damage, and not for the other 4 categories. But I don't know if there's anything special about you directly sending your dog, in a sense, an attack dog. I can think that perhaps then it's similar to an arrow, and if we would hold an arrow is Adam HaMazik. I don't know if we do.
I don't know. Could it be like a muad, you know, from the get-go, because you're... It's well, I guess that's an animal behaving.
No, Muad is an animal independent of you.
Okay.
And the dog,
well, you would want to claim it.
On purpose set him out.
Well, it's an animal behaving in an unexpectedly aggressive manner.
Right.
No. The answer
is always how it is.
Take that apology back.
Like the dog could be... You wouldn't necessarily expect dogs to be attack dogs. Most dogs
aren't. No, it's an attack dog, like a pit bull that you set on your neighbor because you didn't like their dress.
Well, but couldn't you? It's
where'd you grow up?
You could.
What?
It's I mean, in a way, it's an animal. It has that characteristic, at least, of an animal behaving unexpectedly aggressively, although you're directing it.
on its
face. What do you mean you're directing it?
If you sick your dog on somebody,
then it's not unexpected.
It's unexpected by the victim.
Oh! Now I got you.
But it's not the concern. Moad is from the person who should be protecting against it, not the person who's being attacked by it.
Yeah.
In other words, you define Moad or not, Tom or Moad, not by whether you, the victim, expect to be attacked by a dog, but rather you, this person who sicks the dog, expects the dog to attack.
Right.
So you would, assuming that you're sicking the dog on someone,
you're expecting,
and you want to define that dog somehow, it certainly has to be Muad. It has to be. Because you're sicking that dog on somebody with the expectation that it's going to attack.
A Tom dog wouldn't.
You're not sicking that dog. You're not going to sick a dog that has no history of attacking.
Okay, I think it's clear that in that case you have to pay Nezek Shalem, but the question is, which I don't know the answer to, you have to pay more than Nezek Shalem. You have to pay for all the other four payments, because perhaps here the dog is considered to be an extension of you.
And if you see
Chovel
b'chavero, it doesn't say Chovel independently b'chavero. Chovel b'chavero, it can be with a stick, with a stone, with a gun.
If you're holding the stick, then you're certainly right. But if you shot the stick, then it's really not part of you directly. And again, I don't know the answer
to
that.
So if you throw, so David and Goliath, for example?
Okay, I don't know.
The stone is independent.
I don't know. I admit that I don't know the answer.
The dog could be like the arrow, and you might have to pay.
Again, I don't know. I'm just bringing up that possibility. It's a question in my mind.
So you would be stupid to send a dog like that.
Say it again?
You would be stupid to send a dog like that.
Why? You really hate the person?
It's intended.
No, I guess I was surprised that if you shot an arrow, that there was even there was an open question as to that wasn't you who caused the harm.
Look,
to
there are a lot of questions brought up in the Gemara, and I remember many years ago learning that question. It could be the answer is clear. I just don't remember.
Well, if you wanted to injure your neighbor with your dog, you would get a Muad dog and just let it go by itself.
Now we're going to go on. So we're reading on in the Mishnah.
Yes.
To the rest of the Mishnah. And after the Mishnah opened and said there are Hamisha Dvarim, then there follow five different sections in the Mishnah, each explaining these Hamisha Dvarim. So let's read them. It begins with b'nezek ketzad. There's the preposition again, b'nezek ketzad. Concerning nezek, how so? Simei et eino, which means he gouged out his eye. Kata et yado, he cut off his hand. Shavar et raglo, he broke his leg. Ro'in oto ke'ilu hu evid nimkar b'shuk. We see him as if he is a slave sold in the market. V'shamin kamaya yafeh v'chamahu yafeh. And we shamin, we estimate, we evaluate, we appraise is a better word. How much he was yafeh. Yafeh doesn't mean beautiful, it means worth. How much he was worth and how much he is worth. In other words, if I had my arm removed by Jeremy, then we would go to the marketplace, the Evid marketplace, and see how much what I've been worth on the slave block with and without that limb that is now missing.
So now they are losing this capacity today, since we have no slaves.
You're right. I don't know how we evaluate this today.
But this is done all the time for disability insurance. So
tell us how it's done. I don't know.
So you, in that case, it would be more specific. So not like you're a, a teacher.
Different.
Can you, to what extent does this affect your ability?
Yeah, to make a living.
To do your living. Disability insurance. You're a doctor. You're a surgeon. And one of your fingers is removed. You can't work in your chosen profession, not as a slave. In other words, you get burned. And, it doesn't affect how much you can lift if that's what the slave market is. So Mike's comment, I think, is terribly well put. It's not, I wouldn't think that you would just put it on the slave market and, you have one finger less. You can still do all the work as a slave. But you can't do, if you were a surgeon, you can't do your work anymore. Right. Or a piano, right, exactly, a musician, and you can't use your fingers anymore. So,
but what do you do with kids?
And what they would become is an excellent question. I didn't mean to get us off.
Don't apologize.
I'd like to apologize. I'd like to apologize for apologizing.
What Bob just mentioned, that what Amiel just mentioned, is going to bring us to the question of the relationship between Nezik and Shevet.
Yeah. Hmm.
Right, because Shevet is about the loss of ability to make a living. Mm-hmm. So when we get to Shevet, we'll talk about that relationship between Nezik and
but
Shevet here.
Isn't Shevet only temporary until you...
Let's wait till we get to it.
Okay. But if you lose your arm, you can't do all kinds of things. You can't cook, you can't drive mm-hmm. a car. Mm-hmm. It's not just that you can't
you can,
be
but do it
what
less
you were doing.
Right.
Okay, so I want to ask a question or two concerning what we just learned in these two lines about Nezik. There is an inconsistency in the three examples given. Let me be more specific. Two of them are different, sure. very mm-hmm. different from one of them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's the difference?
The third one is healable.
Right. Simei et eino is a permanent disability. Kata et yado is a permanent disability. Shavar et raglo is a permanent disability.
Mm-hmm. Or is not?
No.
Is a healable disability.
Yeah. Thank you. But that brings up a question. Why did the Mishnah give us two that are permanent disabilities and one that heals? And it really begins to make very little sense, because if we're going out to the slave market, well, then just wait a month for the limb to heal. What's going on?
Well, maybe they wanted to make the point that it was different kinds of injuries, too. What if you hurt somebody's eye and they didn't lose all their vision in that eye, but they, you know, or their eyes healed, too. I mean, maybe you did something to somebody they couldn't see, but then it came back.
But Simei really means the blind.
I know. That is there. But you broke his foot, so you could take from breaking his foot... breaking his eye.
Yeah.
They didn't want to say every one of them was
here. By the third.
I understand. I hear.
Makes no sense.
I have a different answer.
Okay.
Unless breaking his foot, it doesn't heal up properly.
Right.
Back then,
right.
it was really a question as to whether his foot would heal properly and whether his foot would ever be the same.
Well, and then yes. really, today, even today, it's
even today,
not the same.
Yeah.
I have a friend.
So there is a certain permanent loss of value there.
I suspect that Jeremy is right. I didn't see any of the commentators, but it could be that the commentators didn't mention this because to them it's obvious that when you break a leg, it's permanent damage. It's not obvious to us because we live in a different age. And once we assume that this is talking about permanent damage, then we understand the matter of the slave market here. It's not something that's healable. I also wanted to point out that in these two lines about Nezik Keitzad, we can distinguish in what was said between the principle and the examples. Right? Notice that Simei et Eino is an example. Kata et Yado is an example. Shavar et Raglo is an example.
Mm-hmm.
And then the principle is Ro'in Oto Ki'ilu hu evid nimkar v'shuk, v'shamin kama ya yefeh v'chama hu yefeh. So what it gives is three examples and a principle. Now the minute we realize there are three examples and a principle, we can ask ourselves, why do we need the examples when you have the principle?
I was about to ask that.
Right? Why didn't it just say...
Why do we need three?
Okay, good question. Why didn't it just say... beginning from the word ro'inoto kilu hu evid. Why didn't say b'nezek heitzad, concerning damage, how so? We see him as if he is a slave on the block, and we appraise how much he was worth and how much he is worth. Why the three examples? And I think that the answer is what Jeremy said. The three examples that are all permanent damage, to tell you what we're talking about is permanent damage.
Right.
I guess.
Well, so, do you really need three?
So, what do you need three? So, that I don't have an answer to.
Well, you certainly need more than one, because then maybe you could just, maybe, well, maybe it's three to illustrate to what extent the damage is. In other words, if I don't know, because maybe it's any damage. But maybe you would think if you only gave, say, one example,
broke a finger,
then you would think, well, or if you just gave the example of putting out someone's eye, then you might think, well, then I stopped short of putting out his eye, so maybe I don't owe him anything. Now, why three rather than two is something different, but you certainly can't stop with just one, I think.
Well, it looks like reading ahead a little bit that they kind of, this is the simplest one, and they sort of get into these gory examples on each one of these categories.
Each example is fitting the particular category that will be.
You know what? There's another thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's an issue of big debilitation. One makes him not see, one makes him not be able to use his hands, one makes him non-movable. I mean, this is very big debilitations.
Yes.
It's not like broke his fingernail or cut his hair.
Yeah. Although, if he did cut off one finger, I assume that the law would be the same.
Yeah, yes, but not, I don't know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Probably it's the difference in how much nezek.
A slave who's missing an arm has more of a loss than a slave who's missing a finger. Okay, so that's nezek. Let's go on to tsar. It says tsar. Notice it doesn't say bitsar ketzad.
That's weird. Yeah.
And I assume that's just a matter of saving words, but it means the same thing.
Or a third source.
Or?
A third source.
I don't know. Here it's clearly explaining the earlier line that gave us Nezek, Tsar, Ripui, Shevet, Boshet in that order. And here the Mishnah is explaining them in that order.
But they did Ben Nezek, it said.
Yeah, and here it doesn't say Bitsar. You're right. So anyway, so Tsar, no, tell me something about Tsar, and says the Mishnah the following about Tsar. Kava'o v'shafud over masmer. He burnt him with a spit or a nail, and it means obviously a red hot nail. The filu al tziporno, and even on his fingernail. Makom sheino se chavura, a place that doesn't cause a wound. Right? If I put this spit on your fingernail, I guess it doesn't cause a noticeable wound.
Uh-huh.
It still could cause a lot of pain.
Yes.
But there won't be anything. That bears witness to that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference between Nezek and Tsar.
Wait a second. Omdin kama adam kayotse vizer rotse litol liot mitzta'er kak. We estimate Omdin is similar to Shamin, but Shamin is concerning value, whereas Omdin is simply an estimation. Of how much a man like this would be willing to take to have that pain caused to him.
Wow.
How much would I have to pay you to burn your fingernail?
Yeah.
All right.
And let me tell you, I've been thinking about this a lot for the past few days.
I'll buy your fingernail for $10. $1,000.
$1,000. How long are you talking?
$1,000,000. Okay.
Yeah, $1,000,000.
$1,000,000 fingernail goes.
So in other words, if I burnt you with a burning hot nail, and even if I cause no noticeable damage, but I cause you pain, and there might not be any nezik involved, it didn't cause you any permanent loss,
disability,
right? But I just caused you a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
I have to pay you even for the pain. And how do we estimate how much that is? It tells you a very good way of estimating how much I have to pay you.
Can we talk about that?
Yeah.
What does it tell you? How to estimate that? What does it tell you?
How much such a man...
With such a man, what does that mean?
Well, just a regular guy in his position, like whether he's wealthy, whether he's used to working hard, whether he has tough skin, whether he's a slave.
Look, people are paying Jeremy to make these terrible phone calls.
Wait a second.
So there are two ways. One's the reasonable man, an average everyday person who will either accept or not accept being burned, and how much is that going to cost them. And then there's the specific man that you burned.
Right.
And that particular man, you know, we claim it in law, you know, you find your victim as you find them. They may have a hypersensitivity to whatever that damage was. And they would accept nothing less than a lot to be burned, whereas the reasonable person would accept X to be burned. And so when you say yeah. mm-hmm. such a man, what does that mean?
You have to convince the court that there's this question. Class that's of very point. Sensitive people that you're part of.
So the Mishnah doesn't say that we ask the guy who got damaged.
Because he would always say he would.
Right, how much you would have taken yesterday for that. For it doesn't say that.
Especially after it's already happened.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I don't know.
You get hit over the head with a stick, and, you know, the average person would get a bump, and you'd go on, and how much would that be worth? There are people that have what are called eggshell skulls, or so, yeah, eggshell skulls, right? Where you just touch them and they crack. How much would it be worth? It's a difference. Yeah. I don't know.
So I don't know.
Just when you had said it was clear as to what it said it was, I'm
so
sure
what
it does.
So the question is, what does it mean, Adam ki yotze bezeh? A man like him. Mm-hmm. I guess it means someone of the same age, someone of the same... It doesn't say an average man. It doesn't say an average man. It's Adam ki yotze bezeh, a man like him. I guess it's the same, like Mary Beth was saying, the same age, the same socioeconomic class, but it doesn't seem to make...
It's open for a lot of arguments.
Okay, but it doesn't seem to take into account the fact that it could be this particular person that got burnt had a special situation. I suppose in those days they didn't really know about special situations like that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if there's a defined illness like that, maybe, and you can talk about a person like that who has such and such illness, unless it's a, like, one person all the world, then you probably couldn't make that argument. But if it's an illness or a frailty that's documented, then I imagine you probably apply it in the same way.
Again, could be.
Imagine.
Because you're distinguishing, I guess, between a slave and the first, or the equivalent on a slave market versus here he's being considered, I guess, in his actual context.
Mm-hmm. In a general sense, in his actual context.
In other words, the first one was everybody's the same, you're just, you're on the slave market, you're being bit on, whatever, and now you're talking about the specific.
Right, so it's not like...
I don't know about the first one, because just because it says like a slave on the market doesn't mean that you're saying that your profession's now a slave. I mean, like, I think it's like the process in which they sell slaves on the market, that's how it's going to be done to you.
Right, so that's how you would compute the value based on, like, a slave who had, you know, was unable to do certain tasks because of this impairment. How much would that be, they be worth, I guess, for their labor? Presumably it was just manual labor. And here it maybe seems to take into account...
No, I'm saying you don't look at that person as if he was a slave.
No,
you
put
that person in a process that a slave would have to go through.
Right, but I'm saying you estimate their value based on a more, like, an objective process of, like, ability for manual labor in, you know, like the same way you would, say, go and hire somebody for or hire yourself for for a manual task versus particular to you as an, I guess what you're getting at, to you as an individual. I don't know. Seems like it's there's this distinction between that.
Okay, now Ripui is the third category, and indeed that's the same order that the five payments were found at the beginning of the Mishnah and Ripui. What can we know about that?
Medical expenses?
Excuse me, I just wanted to go back to the second case of Tsar and add something. Mm-hmm. In the first case of Nezik, we pointed out that there were examples and there was a principle.
Uh-huh.
And we tried to explain why we need both the examples and the principle.
Mm-hmm.
In the second case of Tsar, let's notice if we have examples or principles or both?
Both. You have examples and then the principle.
Right, same thing. We have examples, then we have the principle. Okay, the principle is the sentence beginning with the word omdim. We estimate. Why did we have also the example there? The example is meaning to tell us that it, even if it's the type of damage done that has no observable result, that doesn't mean there was no tsar. And if there was tsar, you have to pay, even though there's no observable result. There's no wound created.
What did they do today, Bob? What happens if somebody beats somebody?
You get as much money as you possibly can.
No, but are there categories?
Sure.
The same as those?
Sure. Lost wages. Similar anyway. Lost wages, pain and suffering, all those kinds of things. Medical expenses, things like that.
Mm-hmm. What's embarrassment?
I don't remember.
There wouldn't be embarrassment. Well,
like reputation?
Pain and suffering, I guess, would be closer to that.
I was talking to a girl who broke her leg in a motorcycle accident. And she was asking me what I was going to do with Baby Drosh, and I was telling her this Mishnah, and she says, oh yeah, that's exactly what they call it when they pay her money. They actually called it Nezik Tzar Ripui Shevet.
Not in Hebrew, though.
In Hebrew.
Oh, this was in England.
This
Israel.
Was Israel, yeah. They call it by
so they use in
the... They don't have the Boshet one, because this society is not based on Boshet like it used to be, but they actually have Nezik Tzar Ripui Shevet, and the same exact words used.
Okay. Oh, yeah, lawyers. Yeah, interesting.
Okay, so let's go on. So now we're talking about Ripui. And what the Mishnah says is Hikahu Hayav Lirapoto. Right? If he... Hikahu literally means struck him, but it in general means if you did damage to him, you have to heal him. Which doesn't mean that you literally... It means you have to pay to heal him. You have to pay for the doctor bills. And then it goes on to explain. Aluvo Tzemachim. Now, the word smachim in Hebrew today means plants.
Plants.
Right.
So it says that sprouted on him plants. No, it doesn't mean that. Actually, we don't know exactly what it means.
Therapeutic plants.
Say it again?
Therapeutic plants.
No. We don't know what it means. It's something developed in the scab.
I think it's a growth.
Some strange growth developed in the scab.
Infection.
Yeah.
Could be an infection, some type of gangrene. It's not clear. I looked it up. We don't really know what it means. And it goes on and says, "Im machamata makah hayav." If it's because of the injury, obligated, culpable. Shalom machamata makah patur. If it's not because of the injury, exempt. Now that, of course, is very difficult to understand because it's obvious.
Yes.
Right. Well, if it was because he went to a crummy doctor and the doctor goofed up when he did the bandage or something.
Very good point. That's very close to what the Gemara is going to say. That's very good.
Really?
Because if you take it at face value, it doesn't say anything. If the infection developed, assuming it means infection, directly as a result of the makah, chayav, and if not, then patur. Of course, I mean, if you hit me on my arm, then I got a toothache. Of course, it's not machmata makah, and of course you don't have to pay. So what is it saying? So the Gemara is going to say something similar to what Mary Beth said to explain why it's not obvious in the Mishnah how to say it. Because we don't want the Mishnah to be saying obvious things and it doesn't have to say it. Then it goes on to say something further. Chayta v'nistara. Chayta, of course, the root is chet yud hey, which means to live. What it means, chayta means it got healed.
Really?
V'nistara means it got unhealed.
Nistara
literally means to
destroy.
Destroy. It got healed and it got unhealed. In other words, it looked like it was healing well, and the scab was healing fine, and then suddenly you had a medical regression. Is that the right word? Medical?
A relapse.
Yeah.
Relapse.
Some people have car accidents and they see the result after quite a while.
But this implies that they had a problem that then got fixed and then recurred. Right, versus not.
Well, let's read the sentence to the end. Chaytav v'nistara, chaytav v'nistara, chayav l'rapoto. In other words, it healed and it got relapsed,
unhealed.
Heal and relapse, chayav l'rapoto. But then it says, "Hayta kol tzorcha," was healed completely. Eino chayav l'rapoto. In other words, if there was a relapse that happened before it was completely healed, then you have to pay again and again and again. But if it was completely healed and then something happened, then you don't have to pay.
How do you distinguish?
Good question.
Like that length of time or something?
Again, good question. I guess it could be very complicated. But because basically, if I got hit on the hand and I got a big infection and a big scab, and then it completely healed, there was no sign of it, then it came back 2 weeks ago, don't have to pay. But if there was a little sign still left that it wasn't completely healed, then it relapsed and you have to pay. I understand it's much more complicated today than it was then.
Didn't it create a weakness in that organ?
I guess they weren't aware of such things. I'm just guessing.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly it. Can I just ask one thing? Nistara, I don't know that it would make sense, but why is it not like hidden?
No. It's like you can listor rochacha. You can disprove it. You can destroy it.
It's one of the 39 melachot. There's bone and then there's soter.
Very good.
Destroy.
Very good.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay, Shevet.
Right.
So what about Shevet? What can we learn about Shevet? Before Shevet.
Oh, Shevet. Mm-hmm.
Back to Ripui. I also wanted to ask the same question I asked earlier. Do we see here examples and principles, or only examples, or only principles, or both?
There's examples.
There's examples. Right. And there's also principles. So again, we have both, I think. I think we'd say we have both. Okay, now let's go on to Shevet, which means, like we said, lack of ability to work. You have to Shevet at home. You have to sit at home. Ro'in oto ke'ilu hu shomea kishu'in. We see him as if he is a watchman in a
watermelon
patch.
Kishuin was watermelon. Remember, in the Torah, zacharnu et hashumim v'kishuim. It's not zucchini. It was one of the many mistakes Ben Yehuda did when he reeled in the Hebrew badly.
But how do we know that?
I read it by some biologist in Israel. Uh-huh. I was very active in the Chevra Laganat HaTeva a zillion years ago.
Uh-huh.
And the kishuim, there were no kishuim of the kind that we call today kishuim in Egypt at the time. This is kind of...
Uh-huh. But they did have watermelons.
They did have watermelons, yeah.
This translates as to...
zucchini?
Cucumber.
I've also seen that translation. I've seen that
so
translation.
So apparently there's debate about it.
It's watermelon or cucumber.
It can be, yeah.
But we get the idea.
Mm-hmm. But definitely not zucchini.
Minimum wage.
No, there's, right, minimum wage, exactly.
Thank you. So
it's
only
pay him.
So
he's
the CEO
wage.
Of Donald Trump Industries or something. He's not going to get it.
Everybody gets paid as if they were watching a...
Well, let's see the next few words. Shekvar natan lo demei yado u demei raglo.
Ah, so that's an addition.
Because we already, because already gave him the worth of his hand and the worth of his foot. Right? We already had the matter of Nezik.
Yes.
How much is a person worth with or without a foot? We
and
paid him for that already.
Paid for medicine.
For the foot. But now we want to pay him just for this matter of Shevet. So then
it's
we...
It's unemployment.
Yes, that's what it is. It's unemployment.
Right, versus compensation for lost wages.
Yes.
For, like, that you would have made as CEO. Whatever.
Yeah, unemployment is even to all people, right?
Oh, okay.
In America now.
But unemployment does go according to what you would have made had
really?
You been working.
Is it?
Yeah.
At least in Israel.
Really?
Yeah.
How about
it
here?
It should be like that.
I think
how
so.
About here?
That makes sense that it would be because
so
you would
if you make
different
a
bills.
If you make a million a year, you're paid a million.
No, there's a limit. There's a tikra.
It's a percentage of of your paycheck.
Okay, so let's go on now. Let's go.
Once again, there was no examples in this one.
Okay, right. In this case, right, there's no examples. So notice how Shevet is different from the other cases we've had earlier. For some reason, no examples, just a principle. And then we get to Boshet. Boshet is going to be very interesting. Humiliation. Disgrace. Hakol lefi hamivayesh vamitvayesh. It's all according to the humiliator and the humiliatee, if I can use that language.
Or humiliated.
Humiliated, thank you, it's better. I like to, coin words. Which, of course, is a principle.
So.
And then examples.
So this is like the pain. It's individual.
It's individual.
How much you pay...
Well, no, it's not individual. It's, let's say, it's class-based or category-based. And you know what Loan said earlier is very interesting. I think you said that today there's no such a thing because the society today is much less based on matters of honor.
Right, honor and humiliation.
Yeah, but of course in ancient societies, at least in some ancient societies, the matter of honor and social humiliation plays a much, much larger role than it does in our society.
And by the same token, someone very high up could insult a slave, and it was not considered that much of an insult.
And that's what this is talking about.
So then we get exactly to the question, how do we gauge the severity of an insult? And it is a matter of classes. Mm-hmm. But how exactly does it work? We'll see a very interesting machloket between Rashi and the Meiri in a few minutes. So here we read, as far as examples, Hamivayesh et ha'arum. You humiliate someone who's naked. In other words, if you have someone who's willing to walk around naked, you might say, well, that person doesn't feel humiliation, so if I punch him in the nose and he has to walk around with a bloody nose, that obviously doesn't humiliate him any more than walking around naked, so I don't have to pay for humiliation in this case. It's going to say not so.
It's a brain damage? Like a bathhouse or something?
Say again?
It's a brain damaged person?
No.
No, someone who
walks around naked.
Someone who wants to be like Adam and Eve.
Let's read on.
Go back.
Hamivayesh et ha'arum. Arum. By the way, it could be someone who just lost their clothes in the wind.
Oh my gosh.
No, but they're ready in a situation of that humiliation. And you might think I'm not adding to it if I call them something like name or whatever. Hamivayesh et ha'sumah, you cause humiliation to a blind person, and what it probably refers to is a blind person who doesn't know that you're humiliating them because they don't see it. Hamivayesh et ha'yashen, if you let's say, right? I remember when I was in camp. 40 years ago, they had this ugly trick of putting a sleeping person's hand in warm water, which is makes them urinate.
In what? In warm water?
In warm water. They used to do this to little kids. I didn't do it. I tried this too.
Weren't you at the camp at Wimberley? Yeah, more recently. No, I'm just joking.
Oh, I met someone in Israel just 3 days ago who was a counselor at the same camp I was a counselor decades ago. Anyway, okay. So, Hamivayesh et ha'yashen, you embarrass someone who is sleeping. You might say, well, I didn't embarrass him because he's sleeping. He doesn't know that what I did to him. Hayav. In all of these cases, hayav. And actually, what the Gemara goes on to explain is that you embarrassed someone when they were sleeping and they woke up and realized what happened.
Is it like the two children of
or the grandson? It was Knoth, right?
Yeah. So is that really embarrassment?
Well, he didn't even know about it. I guess he must have been told about it at some point because he hears them, but he was seen by the sons who covered him and walked backwards. And
right.
Okay, so let's take that case, right? You're sleeping, and someone uncovers you, and then you wake up. after they put the blankets back.
Was he
back.
Actively uncovered, or was he just ridiculed for being
uncovered? It's not really clear what happened.
I remember.
He says he uncovered himself.
He uncovered himself.
I'm giving, using that as an example. So someone embarrassed you by uncovering you, and then covered you back, and then you woke up, and you were told what happened. Interesting question. At the moment of embarrassment, you weren't embarrassed, because you were sleeping.
Well, it doesn't matter whether you were covered or not.
If everybody else came in and laughed, yeah. And then...
I will give you a modern example.
But when they were laughing, you were sleeping.
Well, that's still, so when still, you wake up, they're going to still be snickering.
Embarrassed forever.
Right. There are cases, and there were cases recently, of guys that somehow through computers photographed women, and the co-workers saw them undressed. They didn't know it until later.
Mm-hmm. Okay, same type
so
of thing.
So it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So something that you're unaware of, okay.
Somehow with a computer, I don't know how they do that.
You just remind me of, I'll just tell this, is ridiculous. I don't have a television at home. I never had a television in Dallas, but I watch television like an hour a week at the JCC on the treadmill. And the program I always like to watch is Special Crimes Unit.
Mm-hmm.
What is it called?
CSI.
Yes. So there was once a program, a episode, which this slightly demented guy put cameras in the bathroom, a public bathroom.
Yes, I know.
Anyway, so that's, yes. Remember that when we learn this.
Yeah.
So anyway, so in all these cases, even though you might think that embarrassment wasn't caused, or even though you might say that at the moment that I did the act, the person wasn't embarrassed because they were sleeping. They only realized later they were embarrassed, but I wasn't doing it anymore. But in all these cases, it's still chayav. The yashen shebiyesh, a sleeping person that caused embarrassment, patur.
Yeah, okay.
You're thinking of what
sleepwalking,
what
somnambulism.
Cases? Yeah,
what?
A sleepwalking.
I could have fell off the bed and caught onto someone's clothing and caused them to be uncovered.
No, I mean, you
or
could
sleepwalking,
also,
right?
Right, you could actually be engaged in much more complicated activities
when you're sleeping.
Sleep, yeah.
So in that case, patur.
Although that would be a really bizarre thing for them.
Well, you have to be irresponsible when you're asleep.
Yeshen shebiyesh patur.
Although Adam HaMazik...
Right, but we did say that if you cause someone damage...
And you didn't.
When
you're
sleeping,
before, yeah.
Like the case in which you went to sleep knowing someone's sleeping underneath you, and you fell
right.
And damaged them, you do have to pay.
But this right? is about bullshit.
But
this
bullshit, you don't have to pay,
exactly.
And bullshit is different.
Hmm.
So now let's read further. Nafal min hagag vihizik vibiesh. You fell from the roof, and while you were falling down, you fell on someone and broke their leg. Hizik, vibiesh. And you also caused them bullshit somehow. Let's say you uncovered their, you ripped their clothing as you were falling from the gag. Chayav ala nezek ufator ala boshet. You're culpable for the nezek and exempt for the boshet.
I say it's like a sleeper.
Yeah.
Hmm.
I think the idea is this. In order to cause humiliation, you need to mean it.
Exactly. In order to cause humiliation, let's say it differently. In order to be culpable for the humiliation, you have to have done it bekavana.
Intentionally.
Bemezid, intentionally. Right?
Right.
Whereas for nezik, even if you did it unintentionally, adam muad le'olam. You have to pay for whatever you do, even if it's unintentional. The Mishnah we read it an hour ago.
You're getting hot.
Right.
But is that entirely true? What if you're just negligent? You push it. That you have, like, who knows what? I don't know. You do something in which you're just not paying attention, and you're not sleeping. You didn't fall off a roof. You're just not paying attention.
I hear.
Like you should. And then
so,
you run into. You're looking this way. You run into somebody. You're running this way and looking that way.
You
run into somebody.
So I don't know the answer to your question. But I can tell you that the Gemara talks about five different levels of intentionality.
Mm-hmm.
And the answer will be, based on that scale, were you in a level of intentionality that classifies, that that qualifies as kavanah. Mm-hmm. Different levels of kavanah. Mm-hmm. So we read Hayav Alanezik Ufator Laboshet Shene'emar, and this is going to be very interesting. Now we'll talk about this last part of the Mishnah for a long time. V'shalcha yada v'chzika bimvushav. Eino Hayav Alaboshet ad shehe mitkaven. I'm skipping the verse for a second, but we learn from this verse, Eino Hayav Alaboshet, you're not culpable for boshet until you will be doing it intentionally. So I'll go back to the verse very soon, but let's just do some other things first.
Verse, right?
Yes. And I'm happy we have Chumashim on the table.
That.
So now it says you don't have to pay for the boshet until you did it intentionally. So we said nezik, whether it's intentional or not intentional. Boshet only when it's intentional. That leaves three questions unanswered.
How do you prove
the other ones?
The other three. Right? What about Sar, Shevet, and Ripui? Do they have to be intentional or not? In other words, are they like Nezik or are they like Boshet?
They're like Nezik.
They're like Nezik, and you're right, but how do you know?
Well, it's a physical damage.
Give a textual answer.
It's not mentioned any exception.
Right. It gives an exception for boshet based on the verse. We didn't read the verse yet, but it needs a verse to tell us specifically that boshet requires kavanah. So what seems to be the case is all of the other payments, not just nezik, but the other four, nezik, tsari, pui, Shevet, all four of them, it doesn't matter if you intended or not, if you did what you caused the result, you have to pay. But as far as boshet, there it depends specifically on kavanah. That looks like what it said.
Why do you say it needed a verse?
The last verse.
The fact that it brings a verse to exempt us
from boshet when there's no kavanah.
Mishal chayt yada.
Again, we didn't learn the verse yet because it's complicated. We'll get to it.
But does it necessarily need to...
To strengthen the argument?
Right. Why does it necessarily need to bring a verse?
Why can't it just say, logically...
Oh, why couldn't the Hachamim just make the decision, you mean?
Yeah.
Because then it's only takana.
Right, all of this or is verse to basis. Verses, there's a verse that didn't bring the verses, but there are verses for each of these five types of payments that obligate us. The reason that the Mishnah brings the verse specifically for boshet is because here boshet is different than the others, and it's learned from a certain detail in the verse that talks about boshet.
Okay. Let me make an effort not to apologize, but intended and intention. What does that mean? Does that mean
that's a good question?
Okay.
What do you mean?
Right. And what are the two possibilities?
Intention of the act or intention of the shame.
Right. What do you think?
So
I mean, I can intend to do something that you would find shameful, that I never intended to be shameful.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think intending to shame, because lechzik bimvoshav, it's really an intention to shame.
I think if you shame someone, whether intentional or not, you have to pay for that.
No, because then you're open to all kinds of nuances.
Oh, if I'm particularly...
I'm super sensitive.
You're right.
If you prove that my
sensitivity to
music is not good.
That's not...
You can get very finicky.
It's your fault. If you intended to do somebody harm, then you need to be ready to deal with all the consequences. Even if you weren't aware of how sensitive the person was to... even if you didn't know that that person would be particularly embarrassed by being punched in the face in public, it doesn't matter. You intended to hurt them, and you deal with the consequences.
No,
that's the intentionality of...
This has nothing to do with intention of I mean, all the other things are not intentional.
No, it
harm.
Can be an accident.
Somebody wounds somebody else.
You can
else.
Be clumsy.
You get all those things. Mm-hmm. I mean, I publish a naked picture of you because you're absolutely beautiful. You know, you're a paragon of animals. You know, and that's the
That's the model.
Paragon of what?
Wasn't that the phrase?
Paragon of what?
Animals.
Paragon. I just don't know.
I never heard that.
What did he say?
In the long speech of oh god, I'm so embarrassed.
So impressed that I don't know.
Shakespeare. What a work! A piece of work is man. How infinite and gentle. Isn't it a paragon of animals?
Oh, that's beautiful.
It's beautiful. I love it.
Okay. Thank you, Bob.
It just sounds funny.
Okay, so you're perfect. You're the example, and I publish it. You're embarrassed, but I didn't intend to.
But it said it has to be intentional.
Yes. Again, the question is,
I intended to beautify you.
I intended to take the picture. I intended to publicize it. I intended to make it as an example.
Oh.
But you're embarrassed. I certainly never intended
you know,
to embarrass
you.
I think you have to be intentional.
So now, let me just make two points. One is, remember that the first two words of this Mishnah are Chovel B'Chaviro.
Right.
We're not talking about what Bob said. We're talking about bullshit caused by physically doing something to someone.
As a result.
That's trying to make that clear.
Yes. But, yes.
But putting that aside, let's get back to Bob's question. Jeremy had an answer. Jeremy gave an answer. And I think that Jeremy is right, but I want us to prove it from the text.
So what did Jeremy say?
Jeremy said,
just that if you intended to do harm, you need to pay the consequences for doing harm. Whether you knew how sensitive that person was or not, you have to pay based on the fact that you did harm. And that's, I think, proving from the text is that it says, "Ahovel v'chaveru chayav alav mishum chamisha dvarim." So the boshet is not a result of the fact that you did bullshit to them. It's a result of the fact that you did
chabala,
a physical
injury. That you physically damaged them. Right, that's a result of the damage, not a result of...
But that's not a good proof, because you could say that you only have to pay bullshit when there's kavanah. And what does that mean? Perhaps it means kavanah to levayesh.
Right.
But you say it's only kavanah lahazik.
Right.
To be more exact, chavana lichabel. So how do I know that it's that what's talking about is chavana lichabel and not chavana levayesh? I think you can prove it from the end of the Mishnah.
Well, okay. There's a commentary, I guess, and it says, if he intended to cause damage, however, even though he did not intend to cause shame, he is obligated for the shame.
That's Kati, right? That's Pinchas Kati's commentary there. But let's prove that from the Mishnah.
Whatever that means. Yeah.
Right.
Look at that.
He was a bank clerk, by the way.
He what?
I'll just tell you, since Bob read from that commentary, that Pinchas Kati, that's the name of a person who wrote a commentary on the whole Mishnah about 20 years ago. And today it's called Kahati's Commentary, and it's known around the Jewish world. And I heard many times great praise of him because he was a bank clerk, and in spare time he wrote a commentary on the whole Mishnah.
He was a banker?
Yeah, but there's an end to the story. I heard many, 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 many times, look at the greatness of Pinchas Kahati. He worked 8 hours a day, and he managed to put out this great commentary on the Mishnah. But then I also heard something that kind of popped the balloon. I heard from his
child.
His daughter, right.
I knew it. He neglected the kids.
Right. That she actually said he actually died from the pressure of trying to put out that commentary when he was a bank clerk. Not only did he neglect the whole family, he neglected himself. And he wrote it as kuntrasim, which means he had an installment to meet every week, a deadline to meet. And the pressure killed him. That's what his daughter said. So
it killed her childhood too.
That's horrible.
So
anyway, right back to
the last line. And I won't get us there, but maybe I'll get us. And she puts forth her hand and takes him by the secret parts. Deuteronomy 25:11.
Not so secret.
He is not liable for shame unless he intended.
He is not liable for shame.
He intended...
Jeremy.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Jeremy has it.
Nefal minagag v'hizik uveyesh chayav al hanezek ufatur al haboshet. So he didn't intend the boshet, so that's why he's not chayav on the boshet, right? And that's...
No, he didn't intend to fall.
But he didn't intend.
He didn't intend to be hurt.
Fall.
Nobody intends to fall from the roof. Not even an idiot.
No, but Jeremy, you're right. Ilan is right to prove your point. In other words,
you didn't intend the injury, and you're
and you didn't intend the action.
No, that's when the Mishnah looks for an example of non-intentionality, what type of example does it give us?
An exit.
Non-intentionality of the very
Chabalah.
Which means if there was intentionality for the very Chabalah, you have to pay the boshet.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
Oh, so that answered the whole thing.
So that answers Bob's question.
I don't see how that answers the question, though. Still, is the intention for the act or the intention for the shame?
The intention for the act.
I understand the conclusion, but I'm not understanding why what you read concludes that.
So the Mishnah wants to make a point.
Yep.
The point is that you don't have to pay for boshet unless there's kavanah. We don't know what kavanah we're talking about. So my claim is that we can go through the process of asking ourselves, why did the Mishnah choose the example it chose? It could have chosen other types of examples. It could have given an example in which there was kavanah for the nezik, but there wasn't kavanah for the boshet.
Shame.
It could have picked an example like that, but it didn't. It picked an example of a case in which there was no kavanah for the nezik at all. Why did it choose such an example? Apparently, because that's the point. The point is that there wasn't kavanah for the nezik itself, and that's what causes the patur from the payment for boshet. Which means, just to finish the sentence, that if there was kavanah for the nezik itself, in parentheses, even though there wasn't kavanah for the boshet, you still have to pay boshet.
Mm. So how does that then square with, and she puts forth her hand and takes him by the secret parts?
So I second that question.
See, because clearly putting forth her hand is an intentional act. No question. There was a mistake made, or not a mistake made. And there was the shame caused. And in this particular case, it says, I don't know, if he, and I don't understand the difference in the he and the she, but if he is not liable for shame unless he intended.
Yeah.
Intended what?
What?
But clearly the intention was to put forth the hand.
Yes, but I'm going to claim it wasn't intentionally to cause boshet.
Fine, and then this says he's not liable for the shame unless he intended.
Right, because in this verse you see, well, you know what, let me not talk about the verse and we should get to the verse.
Okay.
We'll get to the verse right now. But I just wanted to make the point we just made, that from the language of the example, before we get to the verse,
the example that the Mishnah
brings, Nafal min agad, fell from the roof.
That example, okay.
Okay. So now let's talk about the verse.
Where is it from?
Okay, so now we have to open up the Chumashim, and it looks to me that we'll end up... Wow, it's already 3:30.
Yeah,
we have another 2 hours of study. This is going to be so fascinating. Okay, so let's open up the verse. You have a place. Everyone has a place. Okay. Open up the verse.
Which verse is it?
It's Deuteronomy 25:11. And we want to read Deuteronomy 25:11-12.
Okay.
So let's have someone, let me look on with Mary Beth, actually. Let's look at the verse. So Deuteronomy 25, we're in the right. Okay. So we want verse 10, 11 and 12. I guess it is. No, 11. Right, 11 and 12. Ki yinatsu anashim, when men will fight, Yachdav, together, two men are fighting. Ish v'achiv, a man and his brother, a man and his fellow. Okay?
Sorry.
See the place? Ki yinatsu anashim yachdav? Ish v'achiv? V'karva eshet ha'achad letzilat ishah. And came close the wife of one of them to save her man, to save her husband. So there's two men fighting. And the woman gets involved in order to save her husband. Miyad Makeyu, from to save him from the hand of the one who is harming him, the one who is Makeyu, harming him. Veshalchayadda, and she sticks out her hand, Vichzika bimbushad, and she takes hold of his private parts. Presumably that's the only way she can stop the fight.
You see, the quotation in the Mishnah is misleading.
The intention is to take hold of his private parts. It doesn't say the intention is to embarrass, but the intention is to cause him great damage, to stop the fight.
That's different.
Is it necessarily to cause him damage, or just to stop the fight?
Well, okay, let's read on. There's a lot to talk about here. There's a lot to talk. We'll talk a whole hour about this, about these two verses. V'katzot et kapa, you should cut off her hand. Lo tahos einecha, your eye shouldn't have mercy.
And you are also damaged.
Okay, so now we have to ask lots of questions. The pshat of the verse, I think, is clear.
Yes.
And in order to explain the pshat of the verse, we're going to read from Philo of Alexandria.
Okay.
Philo was the leader of the Jewish community of Alexandria. We're talking about the decades around the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. Alexandria is the biggest city of the world at that point, I think, perhaps second only to Rome. There's a big Jewish community there. And I'll just say one or two sentences about Philo. He wrote tens of books about Judaism, all in Greek. He seems not to have known Hebrew. And it's very clear from his writings that he wasn't connected to the rabbinic tradition. Even though, just hundreds of miles away in Eretz Yisrael, the rabbinic tradition is growing by leaps and bounds, and it's being studied and propagated by the rabbis. He's unconnected to the rabbinic tradition.
He explains
the Bible according to his personal understanding. Now, it could be that he has roots in some tradition, but not the tradition that became the rabbinic tradition of the Mishnah.
What was the time period again?
It's around the time of the destruction of the Second Temple. I'm not sure if it's the year 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 of the Common Era.
And he's not Jewish.
And he's Jewish.
He is Jewish.
But he doesn't know Hebrew. He's leader of the Jewish community of Alexandria.
With a name like that, Philo?
His interpretation shows certainly Hellenistic influence.
Right.
Although, is that what he called himself? Or is that why Maimonides is how we call, you know, the...
Would he call himself a Hellenist?
No, would he call himself Philo? Was that the name that he gave, you know, that he...
I don't know.
Philon is the lover of something, right?
I don't know.
Philosophy. I just wonder if that was like the name that he's known by, like, you know, say Maimonides to refer to them. I don't know.
We call him Philo of Alexandria. I don't know more than that. So let's read. This is going to be fascinating. Fascinating, fascinating, fascinating. Well, perhaps before we read it, I'll ask you, what's the pshat of the verse? This woman gets a terrible punishment. She says, cut off her hand.
Mm-hmm. And she's trying to save his life.
Why is the punishment so terrible? Don't be ashamed. Don't be embarrassed. Say, what's the pshat? Don't tell me what you believe, what you think Judaism believes. What does the verse say?
Because she's touching the untouchable.
Mm-hmm.
Basically.
Right? That's what it seems to be.
Yeah, it's kind of a private...
No,
the other guy. The other guy. Okay.
I think it's improper.
It's improper.
And it's interesting that the example is with a woman.
Okay.
Who else could it be?
Okay, so Amen? That... So let me ask you the question. Would the deen be different, or would the deen be the same if it was a man?
It'd be different.
It would be different.
Of course.
Right? The punishment is because she's a woman.
Of course.
She did what a woman shouldn't do. That's what seems to be the pshat to the verse.
Right.
That's the only explanation I can think of why katsut et kapa, cut off her hand.
It's a horrible punishment.
It's a horrible punishment for a horrible crime. That would seem to be the pshat. Now let's read Philo. Read Philo. Philo says as follows. Everyone has the sheet?
No, I don't have a sheet.
You don't have a sheet? But you made an extra copy, someone?
Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. I have them pulling two in front of me.
Thank you very much.
And Lon, you have over there.
Nazika to take hold of, not nazik to damage. Is that the verse?
The verse, hichzika to take hold of, yes.
But not okay. Like... So it's not. There's no connection with damage in this.
The word is not connected to the word damage. So he says as follows. Marketplaces and council chambers and courts of justice and large companies and assemblies of numerous crowds and a life in the open air full of arguments and actions relating to war and peace are suited to men. But taking care of the house and remaining at home are the proper duties of women. The virgins having their apartments in the center of the house within the innermost doors. And the full-grown women not going beyond the vestibule and outer courts. He's describing the reality in which he lives in a Hellenistic city of 2,000 years ago. For there are two kinds of states, the great and the small. He's using the word state in a sense we don't use it today, as we'll see. And the larger ones are called really cities. But the smaller ones are called houses. So there's two types of government. Government of the house and government of the city. Mm-hmm. And the superintendence and management of these is allotted to the two sexes separately. The men having the government of the greater, which government is called a polity, and the women that of the smaller, which is called economy. Like when I went to school, there was home economics that only girls could study. Men couldn't study home economics.
Same with me.
We went to shop.
And the women couldn't go to the shop.
Yeah. Therefore, let no woman busy herself about those things which are beyond the province of economy, but let her cultivate solitude. Solitude means don't get involved in the society of men, and not be seen to be going about like a woman who walks the streets in the sight of other men, except when it's necessary for her to go to the temple. If she has any proper regard for herself, and even then let her not go out at noon when the market is full, but after the greater part of the people have returned home, that's when she should go out. Like a well-born woman, a real and true citizen, performing her vows and her sacrifices in tranquility so as to avert evils and to receive blessings.
That's how the Arabs do.
But when men are abusing one another or fighting, for a woman to venture to run out under pretense of assisting or defending them is a blameworthy action and one of no slight shamelessness. Since even in the times of war and of military expeditions and of dangers to their whole native land, the law does not choose that they should be enrolled as its defenders. Looking at what is becoming, that's why a woman not enrolled as soldiers, because we look at what is proper and becoming, which it means the law. Things desirable to preserve, unchangeable at all times and all places. Thinking that this very thing is of itself better than victory or freedom or than any kind of success and prosperity. As we're willing to lose the war as long as we don't send women to fight. That's the worst thing in the world, to send women to fight. If it means we don't have enough soldiers to win. Moreover, if any woman, hearing that her husband is being assaulted, being out of her affection for him, carried away by love for her husband, should yield to the feelings which overpower her and rush forth to aid him, still let her not be so audacious as to behave like a man, outrunning the nature of a woman. Outrunning means, you know, not behaving like a woman should behave. But even while aiding him, let her continue to be a woman. For it should be a very terrible thing if a woman, being desirous to deliver her husband from an insult, should expose herself to insult by exhibiting human life as full of shamelessness and liable to great reproaches for her incurable boldness. For shall a woman utter abuse in the marketplace and give vent to unlawful language? And if another man uses foul language, will not she stop her ears and run away? As even if she does get involved in the fight, let her not do things that only men do, like curse. But as it is now, some women are advanced to such a pitch of shamelessness as not only, though they are women, to give vent to intemperate language and abuse among a crowd of men, but even to strike men and insult them with hands practiced rather in works of the loom and spinning than in blows and assaults. Right? Women shouldn't use their hands for anything but spinning on the loom, not for blows and assaults like competitors in a pancreatum or wrestlers.
Lovely.
So a woman shouldn't leave the house. But if she leaves the house, it shouldn't be when there are men around. If it's men around, she shouldn't get involved in fights. And if she gets involved in fights, she shouldn't use cursing language. And if she gets cursing language, at least she shouldn't use her hands in a fight. and other things indeed may be tolerable, like going out and cursing and using your hands, and what any one might easily bear. But it is a shocking thing if a woman were to proceed to such a degree of boldness to seize hold of the genitalia of one of the men quarreling. For let not such a woman be let go on the ground that she appears to have done this action in order to assist her own husband, but let her be impeached and suffer the punishment due to her excessive audacity, so that if she should ever be inclined to commit the same offense again, she may not have the opportunity of doing so. Another woman also, who might be inclined to be precipitate, may be taught by fear to be moderate and to restrain themselves, and let the punishment be the cutting off of her hand, which has touched what ought not to have touched.
We are not that different.
I guess it means a place where they wrestle in public.
But do the rabbanim say, like, really cut off her hand?
Okay, so Jeremy said, do the rabbanim. Philo is not connected to the rabbinic tradition.
Right.
This statement that we just read seems to me to be the pshat of the verses.
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, we will now see that this interpretation is found nowhere in rabbinic tradition. In many places, including our Mishnah that we just learned, the rabbis go out of their way to give a completely different interpretation to this set of two verses, which comes to teach us how shocked, let's say, the rabbis were by the thought that a woman would be punished in torts for something that a man would not be punished for.
It's like Ben Sorer.
Yes, it is. It's very similar in the sense that there are certain cases in the Torah that whatever the pshat might be, it's clear to our tradition. It doesn't mean that, because it can't be. Because it just goes against the grain of deeply cherished notions. Let's now do this in an orderly fashion. Now that we see what the verse seems to say as far as pshat, and we hear that Philo actually said this 2,000 years ago, how did the rabbis understand the verse? That brings us back to our Mishnah. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Philo and our Mishnah are explaining the same verse. So we go back to our Mishnah, and we're talking about boshet, right? We're talking about the damage done, the damage of boshet. And what did the rabbis learn from the verse? They learned that boshet is only when there was intention levayesh. To do the damage. What do we know about boshet? When humiliation was caused, the person who humiliated has to pay.
Mm-hmm.
Now we go back to the verse. We have to find that in the verse. We have to find in the verse a case of someone intending to do damage, and they have to pay for that. Where do you see that in the verse? Or put it differently, where did the rabbi see that in the verse? Where did Chazal see that in the verse?
She paid with her hand.
So, according to our tradition, according to this Mishnah, what does katzot et kapah mean? Cut off her hand. What does it mean?
The value of her hand.
Right.
To take away the... Right.
Clearly, when the verse says katzot et kapah, cut off her hand, if the rabbis take that verse to mean you have to pay for boshet caused, they're interpreting the words and cut off her hand as pay money. Where else do we see a similar case?
Eye for an eye.
Eye for an eye. Right? Eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, wound for a wound. Just like that's interpreted to mean money, and we'll get to that in another few minutes if we have time, which we really don't. Our set of verses being interpreted in the same fashion. Katzot et kapah, cut off her hand, means pay. But we also now have to interpret not just the words that say cut off her hand, but the previous words. The previous words say two men are fighting. The woman gets involved. She takes hold of what she's not supposed to take hold of. And her punishment is pay.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you see in the verse? What the rabbis talk about? Boshet.
So just that's the euphemism for the genitals, right?
Yeah, so actually, so what is the case? The case is two men were fighting, and if we read the verse according to Philo, she gets involved because she wants to save her husband. Apparently she thinks there's no other way to save him, but still, nevertheless, Philo says she did something that she shouldn't have done, even if her husband would have been completely even damaged and killed in the fight, she shouldn't have done what she did. That's the way Philo read it, which might be the pshat. But that's not the way the rabbis read it. The rabbis read it that she did damage that was completely and absolutely unjustified. That's where the rabbis are reading it, right? That's all these cases of chovel b'chaviro, someone who injures his fellow. It's not talking about injuring your fellow in self-defense. It's talking about injuring your fellow for no reason, illegally. Which means the rabbis are reading the verse as follows. Two men are fighting. They're just having a good time. They're wrestling. Nothing's going to happen.
Mm.
And this person suddenly gets involved in a fight and takes hold of the guy's private parts. And she is a chovel b'chaviro. She's causing damage to someone. It has to be read, according to the rabbis, as unjustified. It's not self-defense. It's not defending her husband. That background is not relevant. It's not that she's defending her husband. They were just playing around.
But Lancel is not to rescue.
I'm telling you what the rabbis seem to have interpreted.
Okay.
It might be a difficult reading. Which means, so the rabbis were willing to read a difficult reading or not to read the reading of a Philo. That's the way I understand it. Okay, so these two...
Why couldn't they be reading it according to Philo except for the part of cutting off the hand? Why shouldn't we just say that the rabbis lived in a time and a place where it wasn't appropriate, according to like Philo says, for a woman to run out and grab another man by the genitals, even if she's saving her husband? But fine, we don't want to cut off her hand, so we make her pay because it's something which is societally unacceptable.
Because if that was the case, then the rabbis couldn't learn from that verse the general category of bullshit.
Oh, okay.
Right? Right. First of all, if that was the case, it would be applicable to women and not to men. Mm-hmm. Which is clearly not the case of Boshet. It's applicable to men and women. But secondly, if it was like you're saying, the crime wouldn't be the crime of chovel v'chaviro.
Right.
The crime would be the crime of doing something that is societally unacceptable.
Right.
But no, that's not the way the rabbis read it. They read it as a case of chovel b'chaviro. This woman is simply doing damage to someone.
Which is unjustified.
It's damage. It causes great bullshit. So in addition to the other things she has to pay, this verse tells us that if she does something that causes great bullshit, she has to pay. So to summarize what we're saying, the fact that two men are fighting becomes irrelevant for the rabbis. Here's just a person, and I say person, not necessarily woman. According to the rabbis, the fact that it's a woman is irrelevant. I understand that's not the pshat. The pshat says woman, woman, woman. But the rabbis, again, are not willing to see this as gender-specific. They see it as gender-non-specific. And it's just a case in which a human being, man or woman, causes unjustified habalat to another person, that in addition to the nezik, tsar, ripui, shevet, this verse teaches us boshet. That's what uses the example.
There are no other halachot derived from this?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
From this verse, you mean?
Yes.
It's right here.
Okay.
So from this we learn boshet. From this verse we learn boshet. And since it says that she hichzika, she took hold of that, she did it on purpose.
You learn
from that, only when the nezik is caused intentionally, is there a payment of boshet. So this is a case in which the rabbis have radically reinterpreted the verse. And again, my assumption is that they radically reinterpret the verse because the pshat is, in their eyes, impossible. It can't be.
And it doesn't matter whether she was intending to insult the man
or
injure him.
Doesn't matter. And like Ilana said earlier, it's possible to say that this is similar to the case of the rebellious son.
Right.
In which the pshat seems to be that you just go out and stone a kid who gets drunk too much. And the rabbis say, that can't be. And they completely reinterpreted the verses. So what I want to do now is see all of the other rabbinic statements I know of that deal with these verses. So it's already 5 minutes to four. I have more time because I don't have to go to another class when the class is canceled. Does everyone have half an hour more, or is it impossible?
I'm fine with it.
Okay, so
I can go for 4 hours more.
I can go for 10 hours.
I'm starting a bit.
Do you have to leave for davening at about 4:40?
I think it's 5:05, something like that. So
we'll end it
up. That's my schedule.
No, that's
okay.
So you have. So I'm looking on the second piece of paper.
So can we feed him first before he goes davening?
So let me see how quickly we can do that. Let me try and do it really quickly so we can have time to eat.
Can we have time
to eat? Actually, because I also want to eat something before I go.
Yes.
Okay.
And so you need to go to davening.
Yeah, why not? I'm not
teaching
another class.
So why won't you feed yourself and then...
Okay, so let's do it.
Okay.
So we're looking at the second piece of paper, where I said D, rabbinic interpretations of the verses in Deuteronomy. We're now going to see a Mishnah, which is from chapter 8 of Sanhedrin, Mishnah 7, only in order to learn something about the way the rabbis use a certain word. Once we learn that, we'll go to another source that's directly related to our subject. And the subject is as follows. The subject is what's called rodef. When one person is pursuing another person to cause a certain type of damage. The most famous example is that I am running after Jeremy to kill him. I have a knife in my hand.
Was there a recent thing in Israel?
Wait a second. Let's just go on, because time is really short. Okay.
Yeah.
And the law says that I'm allowed to, perhaps even commanded, to kill the pursuer before he kills Jeremy. Mix up my metaphors. I said, I'm pursuing Jeremy. Let's say I'm pursuing Jeremy, so Lan is allowed to, and perhaps even commanded, to kill me before I kill Jeremy. What's fascinating is the language the Mishnah uses to explain this concept. When Lan kills me, the language the Mishnah uses is he's saving me. What is he saving me from?
Avera.
From Avera. Okay, so let's read the Mishnah now. The Mishnah says, Ve'elu hen shematzilin otan binafshan. These are those that we save them with their life. Means we save them by taking their life. Lan saves me from the sin of killing Jeremy by taking my life. And that's called hatzalah, that's called saving. And the first example the Mishnah gives, Harodif Achar Haviro Lahorgo, pursuing after his fellow to kill him. Okay? So again, the person who's pursuing his fellow to kill him, a good Samaritan is allowed to and even commanded to save the pursuer by taking his life. And it's called saving. Okay? That's enough from that Mishnah. Then we go to the next page, and we use that information to understand something else, which says as follows. This is the Sifrei Dvarim, which is the halachic midrash of the Tannaitic period on the book of Deuteronomy, and the verse that we are dealing with here is V'katzot et kapa, cut off her hand, the same verse that we see mentioned in the set of verses brought in our Mishnah, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Says the Sifrei, Katsota et Kapa, Milamed Shata Chayav Lehatzila. It teaches that you're obligated to save her.
Wow.
I don't understand yet, but anyway, I'm saving this woman by cutting off her hand. And if the language of saving is being used as we saw just 2 minutes ago, it means saving her from sin.
But she already touched the Mephoshef.
Okay, wait a second. Very good. So apparently, when the verse says katzot et kapa, cut off her hand, we until now assumed that was punishment
after.
after the fact, inflicted by Beit Din. Whether it means cut off her hand literally, as Philo said, or whether it means what the Mishnah says, pay money, right? We assumed it was Beit Din, but now there's a new interpretation. Katzot et Kapa is not Beit Din after the fact. It's a good Samaritan. It's Lan, who just like Lan is commanded to kill me before I kill Jeremy, now Lan is commanded to cut off this woman's hand before she takes hold of someone else's genitalia. It's a new interpretation of the verse. Goes on and says, Minayin she'im einata yehola hatsila bekapa hatsila benafsha Talmud lomar lo tachos einecha. Translation, how do you know that if you're not able to save her with her hand, you save her with her soul? In other words, how do you know if you're not able to prevent her from doing what she's about to do by cutting off her hand, that you actually kill her? How do you know that? The verse says, don't have any pity. Remember, the verse says, cut off her hand, don't have any pity. According to this midrash, it's two stages. If you can't cut off her hand, then kill her. So now what's going on? Apparently what's going on is the following. The rabbis are reading this verse in a third fashion, not like Philo, and not like our Mishnah, but another fashion.
Like Pinchas ben Zimri.
You see here a woman who is about to kill a man. She's going to kill him by pulling on him.
Is it killing?
Yes, yes, yes. When you use the, when you say that we save her from her sin, that only happens in cases of attempted murder. So she is like running after another man to kill him. And this is her only method of killing him. And Lan sees this woman about to kill another man, so he's commanded to cut off her hand. And cutting off her hand is an example of the minimal damage that's necessary to prevent the crime. But if that minimal damage is not enough,
Dafka cutting off her hand, like really cutting off.
Really cutting off her hands. But if that's not enough, then go kill her. That's why it says don't have any pity. So what we just saw is a completely new interpretation of the verses.
So she's a rodef.
She is a rodef, very good. She's the pursuer. And the fact that the two men again are fighting, that's irrelevant. But they're just wrestling and having a good time.
But why is it irrelevant? Most of the time you just jump right to killing them. In this case, you cut off her hand first and then you kill
her. No, there is actually a principle that even when Lan sees me about to kill you, if he's able to...
Minimize the damage.
Yes, minimize damage.
Okay.
How do we know it from here?
Okay.
Let's read on. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ne'amar kan lo techos einecha ve'ne'amar lahalan lo techos einecha, ma lahalan mamon af kan mamon. Translation, Rabbi Yehuda says... It says over here, don't have pity on her, and it says in a different place, don't have it pity. What does it mean, money over there? It means money over here. We don't even have to look right now for the other place where it says, don't have pity. The rabbis interpret it to mean money. So it means money here also. Now, when Rabbi Yehuda says, don't have pity, don't have pity is the bridge that connects between the two verses. Over there, wherever it is, don't have pity is in a context which you have to pay money. So our context is also pay money. It doesn't mean that don't have pity means money. It means that that is the bridge that brings the concept of the money to our verse. The words in the verse that mean money are cut off her hand. So when Rabbi Yehuda says that don't have pity brings the concept of the money into our verse, so that cut off her hand means pay money, but doesn't mean literally, Rabbi Yehuda is not understanding the same way that the first line understood. The first line understood that cut off her hand is not Beit Din, but it's you trying to prevent her from killing someone else. Rabbi Yehuda is a completely different interpretation of the verse, that it is Beit Din when it says cut off her hand, but it means money. So altogether, we've seen three interpretations. Philo's interpretation, that you have a woman here who's trying to save her husband even from death. But she did it in such a terrible fashion that she has to be punished by cutting off her hand, and the crime is only a crime of women. If a man did the same thing, it wouldn't be the same law, because it's a matter of social status. That's according to Philo. Whereas the rabbis avoid that interpretation of Philo and offer two alternative interpretations. One of them is the matter of Rodef, that when it says she's taking hold of the man's private parts, it means she's pursuing a man to kill him, the only fashion she knows that she's able. And what you're supposed to do is cut off her hand before she does the act, the Good Samaritan, and if you can't cut off her hand, then kill her. Don't have any pity. That's one rabbinic interpretation. The other rabbinic interpretation is Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda's interpretation says that cut off her hand means money. Rabbi Yehuda's interpretation is the same interpretation as in our Mishnah.
Mishnah, exactly.
And our Mishnah says that we learn from this verse monetary payment for embarrassment. The Mishnah is learning it like Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda and the Mishnah learn in the following fashion. Here's a woman who does unjustified chabalah, damage to a man, and that unjustified chabalah also causes embarrassment. The law is that the Beit Din katsut et kapat, cut off her hand, which means pay money.
But the woman is trying to save another rodef, the rodef of her husband.
For some, the rabbis are forced not to read the fight between the men as anything serious.
Aha. So she gets involved.
That's out of context. That's out of the Torah seems to indicate that it is, though.
And it's not really. Oh, I'm sorry.
It's hard to see a situation where your husband and someone else are scuffling, and you reach out and grab the other man's genitals.
You is a third party.
You, the woman, the wife.
Third party.
The wife reaches out and grabs your husband's scuffler's genitals, and that's not intended to cause embarrassment or shame.
I think the reading is that she simply does the easiest thing for her to do to disable that man. It's not meant to cause embarrassment. It's meant to cause him tremendous, tremendous pain. It also causes embarrassment.
But the fact, I mean, the embarrassment seems to me to be just, is really forced. It's just, it sounds like it's just a euphemism. The word in the biblical text is just a euphemism for genitals.
Yes, yes, that's true.
I don't get the impression necessarily that it's, I mean, it sounds like it's a.
I think you're right.
It's just an act of you know, just reading it. What would seem to be the plain text is just trying to assist or whatever prevent.
You're right, but that type of action does cause embarrassment.
Rabbi, why do a more meta question? Why do the rabbis have to use? Why do they have to take a verse and bend it so not so out of shape, but to take it pretty obviously out of context? Why couldn't they find a different verse to base the? It's just, it's very painful to see the Torah. Even the rabbis, I have very much trust in rabbis, and they're all great people. It's really hard to see. It feels as though. If the cynical side of me were to speak up and say the rabbis wanted to show something, and so they made the Torah say that.
Right. I understand completely what you're saying.
It feels very wrong.
They
couldn't find anything else. So instead of saying, well, the Torah says this, so that's how we have to go, that's what we have to say. We say this is what we want to say, so this is what we make the Torah say.
Used it for two purposes.
Because they needed
a Torah proof, and number two, which was not a proof, of course, and number two, they wanted to fight the pshat of that verse.
So look, what you're bringing up is a major, major, issue. Major matter,
yeah.
And this Drasha is at the center of many, many articles on the subject of the very nature of Torah Sheba'al Peh. We're dealing with something very, very basic here. What's the nature of Torah Sheba'al Peh? Now, you could claim, as many have claimed, that the rabbis are saying what they're saying, the basis of a tradition. that there must have been a Torshavah pet that goes back to the Sanhedrin, or even goes back to Moshe at Sinai. And the, in my personal opinion, the reason we would perhaps prefer to say that is because of what you said, because we can't believe the rabbis would have quote unquote made it up. Another way of looking at it is that this is an example of the very nature of Torah Shabbat Peh, which is that the Torah gave human beings the responsibility to interpret Torah. I don't have to remind you of the story of Tanor Shel Achnai.
Right.
We did that in the class at Temple Emmanuel. We're going to do it again on this Wednesday, by the way, in which very clearly, it's not in heaven. Kodesh Baruch Hu gives the rabbis the authority, the responsibility to interpret Torah according to them, according to their understanding.
Yeah, but what stops a very well learned group of rabbis who have a certain bent towards wanting to say something from paskening away half the halachot of Torah?
So the answer to that depends on who you ask. If you go in the first direction, that everything here is simply the recording of tradition, then your question doesn't begin.
Right.
If you read it the way I'm suggesting, based on Tanor Shel Achnai and based on what I think we have here, the answer is that there's nothing to prevent them. And that's the whole point. The whole point is that the Kodesh Baruch Hu gave the Torah as raw materials to the Jewish people to understand as they see fit. It has to be on the basis of interpretation. But
so long as
apparently that interpretation can be pretty far-fetched. Now, I'm not giving you a full answer to your question. Understand that what comes out of this is that the Torah is malleable. The Torah is flexible. It could become whatever the Jewish people make of it. And, of course, here we get into questions that I always get. So, it can be reformed, it can be conservative, you can make anything you want of it. The answer to that is, it's not you. It's the authorities, the duly appointed authorities of the Jewish people. But it does mean that Torah is flexible, is malleable. What are the boundaries to that? I have no idea.
What are the duly appointed authorities?
And that's another question, a bigger question, right?
What was your question?
What are the duly appointed authorities? How do you, measure that? Is it by numbers, majority?
Right. And those questions are debated literally in our generation.
We don't have Sanhedrin.
And this question arises, the question that you're asking arises on this verse, this drasha, other drasha, like Ben Sora Moreh.
Right.
It arises on the verses about Sota. You see the interpretation that the rabbis gave to Sota also. And it's in tens of other places. The nature of Torah Shel Peh seems to be very, very radical and very, very flexible in many places. And many, many places there seems to be a disjoint between Torah Shel Bektav and Torah Shel Bal Peh. So again, if you give the answer of tradition, okay.
It's all given already.
But it certainly doesn't seem to me like that. And then you have to confront what seems to me to be the historical truth that we believe as Jews that the Torah is raw materials. By the way, if you've ever heard me tell the story of... Okay, let me tell the story. I'll put the sources aside. I think we've done basically enough today.
Can I serve soup while you talk?
Serve soup. I'll tell the story while Lana's going to serve soup. So the story goes like this. This is found in the second chapter of a Midrash called Tana Devi Eliyahu. Another name for the Midrash is Eliyahu Zuta. And the Midrash goes like this. There was once a king who had two beloved servants, two beloved ministers in his cabinet. Take it back. To begin the story at the beginning. The story goes like this. There was once a heretic who approached the rabbi, and the heretic said, the written Torah is from God, but the oral Torah isn't. And the rabbi said, you're wrong. The oral Torah is from God as well. What's the difference between the oral and the written Torah? I'll tell you a parable. And the parable is as follows. There was once a king that had two servants, two ministers. They're both very beloved. And he gave them both a bundle of flax and a bundle of wheat. To this one he gave a bundle of flax and wheat. To this one he gave a bundle of flax and a bundle of wheat. And he said to them, here's your present. I'm going off now. I'll be back. And one of the servants took the wheat and made it into flour and made it into bread and baked two loaves and put them on the table. And from the flax he made a tablecloth and he put it over the bread. And the other servant didn't do anything. He left the flax and he left the wheat. And then the king came back and he said to his servant, show me what I gave you. The next line in the Midrash is, what a shame and what a humiliation, that stupid servant that didn't do anything and can only show the king the raw materials that he had been given. That's the end. So when you start thinking about what it's trying to say, remember that whole story about the king and the two servants will tell you how Torah Sheval Peh is divine like Torah She Bechtav. And what it seems to be saying is that the tablecloth and the bread are Torah Sheval Peh. And they're created by man. But they're divine in the sense that they're made of raw materials that were given for the purpose of making something from them. Now you go deeper into the story and you think about that servant who took the wheat and the flax and kept it under lock and key to present to the king when he comes back. You could say, I would do the same thing. And if the king gave me a present, I don't want to tamper with it because it's royal.
Right.
But apparently, according to this Midrash, you have to overcome that sense of humility and relate to the royal gifts as a challenge of raw materials in which the king actually believes that you have something to add. You can make it something better. It's only raw materials. It's only flax and it's only wheat. In and of themselves, they're not worth anything. And then the challenge of the religious person is to realize that God wants you to be active. God wants you to do something about this. He doesn't want you to leave the Torah on the lock and key and give it a kiss every week. Actually, he wants you to look at it in the same way that you look at electricity and you look at geology and you look at all the periodic table. It's something to do with. It's something to create. It's something to improve. It's something to, like it says in the first chapter of Bereishit, to take the world and conquer it. So, what is Torah Sheba'al Peh? It's the use of God's raw materials to make something better. I understand this doesn't answer the question of who's the duly appointed authorities and what's the proper creation to make from the wheat and what's an improper creation. Is there any boundaries at all of improper and proper? It doesn't answer those questions, but it certainly does tell you that we should look at least according to this Midrash, look at the Torah's raw materials. And from this particular verse about the fight between the men and the woman, the rabbis made of it something pretty unique, pretty unexpected, pretty surprising, but ultimately something that they apparently believed in. And that's enough.
So my assumption is that you go with your second, the second interpretation, which is not Halacham Moshe.
Right. That's the way I read it, on the basis of this Midrash in Eliyahu Zuta. I realize that I can be accused of all different types of crimes of heresy and liberalism.
Which
for,
I'm sure you have been.
Yes. But that's what the sources say.
Now I'm going to tell you something about making flour and things. There's bread here, there's butter here. And oh. I bake the bread.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Ilana.
And there's plenty more soup. We just gave you the first portion, and it's on the counter for all of you to serve yourself more.
Thank you so much. So I'm actually going to take some bread.
Absolutely. You bring me such anxiety that you wouldn't manage to eat on time. Bob has to go to service.
He hasn't paid enough for Tahar.
Right. And Jeremy, it's vegan.
You said davening, but you guys at 505.
So how much longer do you have with us?
It's everywhere.
Well, I have probably one more class here.
We'll see you next time.
Are you delayed your thing?
Yeah, delayed by 1 month because we're running so far behind.
Yeah, that's
Vicky and the baby. Vicky and the baby got sick for like 2 weeks, so.
Oh, so that's what delayed you.
Just set us back.
Do you need help with anything?
Sorry.
When is this Ginger, yeah.
I think it's at 7. The thing at the turquoise center?
Anything. I mean, like,
you
have moving things?
I mean, right now it's just making arrangements, selling what we can sell.
Well, do you want to go to the Muslim center tomorrow? To the blue?
It's not that far away.
It's not far.
Having some success.
It's kind of like a JCC for Turkish.
What we're keeping, you know.
Right, and you can import that.
We have been there before.
Yeah.
You want to come?
No. And I bet people are trying to give you gifts. So. Like, no!
I'm going to try. No, I don't need anything. I need
to make Wednesday's class.
Just cash.
Are you going to come to the Maimonides on Monday?